We all remember in the book of Samuel, we're talking about Israel's rejection of God, that they wanted a king for themselves. They wanted a leader like everybody else. They wanted to be like everyone else and have that human leader. So God instructed Samuel to do that, to find them a king. And he even made, he described who he wanted Samuel to pick as a king. And it was Saul, who was tall, good-looking, dynamic, confident, outgoing, looked good, and he was to be the king. God also told Samuel to warn Israel about what would happen, no matter who their king was, the consequences of having a king and what would happen down the road. And we know, we've seen that happen from Saul's time to today, that man just doesn't have the ability to lead the way that God does. Anyway, lessons learned for good looks and being dynamic, because we know that the next king of Israel was David. Not good looking, nothing special, wasn't anybody that would stand out as you looked at him, kind of young man, no stature or anything else. And we learn that maybe, just maybe, looks are deceiving. Maybe we're looking in the wrong place for a person's worth, a person's abilities, a person's commitment to God. Many of you remember back in 1960 when the Kennedy and Nixon campaign was going on. And that was the first televised debate for anyone running for office. Even the way these men dressed played a part in Kennedy getting elected. And till this day, there's still debate on whether Nixon was set up or not. But Kennedy was dressed, as I recall, in a blue suit, looking good, looking sharp. Nixon was in a gray suit, which blended right into the backdrop, the background, so he looked kind of blah. And just that by itself was a major factor in Kennedy's election, because he looked presidential. He looked good. He looked confident. And he looked the part. But what's there? You know, we know today that that plays a part in presidential elections still today. How does a person look? Does he look presidential? And if he looks presidential, that's half the battle. But what substance is there? What kind of an example do these men set? Well, we know during campaigns, whether it be presidential or any other campaign, that lies are told, mistruths are told, the truth is skirted many times, and dishonesty plays a big part in any campaign. So, do these candidates set a good example? Just because they look good, just because they look the part. But as we probably all have heard this said to someone, you set a good example for others. You set a good example for others. Maybe someone's even paid us that compliment, that you set a good example. Because people look at us. They look at us. Have we ever received that compliment? Someone telling us that we set a good example for others. Because it can be a positive thing and should be a positive thing, as we set that good example. But in some cases, setting a good example can turn negative. I remember working in a small shop where we were paid by the hour to do a particular job, whatever they had us do. And ever since my first job, my dad always made a point to tell me, when you go to a job, you give your employer the best you have. He instilled that in me. Give your employer the best you have. And that sounds good, but what if I don't like my employer? What if he's not a person who inspires me? What if he doesn't motivate me? It's hard sometimes to give the best you've got when you don't feel like you're appreciated or you just don't happen to like your boss. So sometimes that wasn't easy to accomplish. Other times, my coworkers made me feel like I was letting them down when I was trying to set a good example. Not to gain anything, but that was just my mindset. I'm going to go in, I'm going to do the best job I can do, and at the end of the day, I'm going home. Well, in some places, especially union shops, that's not the thing to do because I had my coworkers telling me I was making them look bad because nobody works that hard here. We just don't do that. Just slow down. Take it easy. That was the feedback I got. And I wasn't really trying to set a good example for them. I was trying to be a good employee and set a good example as an employee, but it really backfired on me because the coworkers didn't look at it that way. They looked at it as something different. But many of you may have found yourself in the same situation. So what do we do? What do we do? Is setting a good example for others that important anyway? Does it matter if we set a good example or we just do what we do and let things fall where they may? You know, God understands who we are, what we're trying to do. Shouldn't that be enough? He's called us into his church. Because ever since coming into God's church, I've wondered, should I worry about setting a good example or does it matter? As long as I do my best to please God, and as long as you do your best to please God, does it matter what kind of an example we set for anybody else? Do I need to go out of my way to set a good example for anybody else? Or do you, as a matter of fact? Because we know in Philippians 2:12 it says, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. So we're all responsible for that. We're responsible for ourselves. It's up to us. So does it really matter? Or would God even expect us, as hard as it is to overcome sin sometimes, as hard as it can be to live a Christian life, would God really expect us to worry about setting a good example? But I want to share with you some quotes about setting a good example from other people. Francis Bacon Sr., who was a statesman and a philosopher in the 15th and 1600s, said this, "He that gives good advice builds with one hand. He that gives counsel and sets a good example builds with both hands. But he that gives admonition and sets a bad example builds with one hand and pulls down with another." So there's a balance there. We need to be balanced in what we do. Benjamin Franklin said, "A good example is the best sermon." We don't have to say a word if we set the right example. Albert Schweitzer said, "Setting a good example is not the main thing in influencing others." It's not the main thing. It's the only thing. It's the only thing. You know, we can fool people. People fool people all the time. Politicians fool us all the time. Actors fool us all the time. But a person's character always floats to the top. It always floats to the top. God knows who we are. We don't. We can't fool him. But if we play games with other people and we try to be someone we're not, or do something that we don't normally do, try to put on a facade, our real character will always float to the top because character can't be hidden behind words. We can't hide all of our life and be who we're not. We're different. We're different than the people in the world because God has called us out of the world. God has looked at you. He's looked at me personally and called us out by name into his church, into his truth, to be different, to set an example of someone who is different. And should we care about the example, should we care about setting an example to others? We have to care. We have to. Because God's given us that responsibility to care what we do, what we say, how we act. The title of my message today is, Are We as Christians Setting a Good Example? Are we as Christians setting a good example? Many of you will remember middle school or junior high years when you were in school. What a crazy time of life for all of us. We were hundreds of kids put in a building together, all experiencing important changes in our lives, all thinking we were grown-ups, why we still wanted to play with the little cars and trucks and the Barbie dolls, but we wanted to look and act like an adult as best we could. We were trying to figure life out. We just didn't know. We were kind of in between. But we dealt with it. Most of us survived those days in our right minds, I hope. But that was a tough time that we had to deal with in our lives. The last thing on my mind or any of my buddies' minds in junior high was setting a good example for anybody. We didn't care about that. Didn't enter our minds. Our biggest deal was looking cool. That's what we had from the time we woke up in the morning till the time we went to bed. Man, I hope I look cool today. I hope I just, you know, had that coolness just shooting out from me. That was what was on our minds. I had me some new boots with the little heels on them, make me a couple inches taller. Had my hair slicked back. I did. Had my pegged pants on. Didn't get any better than that. And that's who we were. We didn't care about anything else. Because we knew that it would never get any better than where we were. This is it. We're cool. The world knows it. We'll all move on together. We didn't care about setting an example. Especially for the adults. You know, we didn't want to set a good example for the adults. We were in junior high. We were cool. And that's all that mattered to us. But sometimes, even to somebody cool, without warning, we lose that coolness. It just goes away. I remember sitting in a class, letting my mind wander instead of paying attention to the teacher. Probably none of you have done that, but I did it once. Just didn't pay attention to the teacher. I was just seeing if you were all saying, why? I think you guys, your minds were wandering here just a minute ago. But you know, I wasn't paying any attention. And the class met in the FFA room, the Future Farmers of America room, and they had, you know, samples of corn around and other farm products around that we had access to. So the teacher was up writing on the blackboard. And for you younger people today, you have the whiteboards, but we had blackboards back then. And he was writing and he would turn his back to us. So as he was writing, I thought it would be cool to shuck a little corn off and throw up at the blackboard. So I did that. Didn't hit him. Didn't intend on hitting him. Just trying to get his attention and distract him. And so he'd look around and didn't see anything, and he'd go back to writing. And I did that 3 times. And finally, the 3rd time, he turned around and he said, unless the person or persons who did this will confess, nobody goes to lunch. You all sit here, and he said, I don't care if it's for the rest of the day. So I'm thinking, I'm too cool to confess. How do I do this? But I knew my likelihood of getting out of that room with 24, 25 other classmates in there, knowing what I did and caused them to miss their lunch, was probably not a good idea. So I stood up and I said, I did it. I did it. So as he released the rest of the class to go to lunch, he walked me down to the principal's office. went in and told the principal what I had done, and back then they had a neutral person give you the paddle because they didn't want emotions involved in all of this, so they would take most of the time down to the shop teacher and go in, and the shop teacher's name was Mr. Woodman, which was good, but the principal would take you in and he would say, you know, Mike gets three licks. He didn't know what for, didn't care what for, but that was what he did. So just before I went in to get my licks, the teacher looked at me and said, Mike, I just want to tell you, you set a good example. You stood up, you confessed, and you didn't, you did the right thing. So you set a good example for the rest of the class. And knowing what I was going into to get, it really didn't set well with me that I set a good example. But I thought, wow, why would he think that? I caused this problem, yet he said I set a good example. And I just couldn't figure that one out. But I know I had a lot of teachers in junior high that set a good example for us. And I still remember some of the examples they set even today that I learned from. By the way they did things, by the way they handled themselves, by the way they dealt with students, they set a good example. And again, I'm sure many of you have those memories too of teachers in school that set a great example. But what does that mean, example? What is that? You know, the American Heritage Dictionary says, one that is representative of a group as a whole. One that is representative of a group as a whole. Or one serving as a pattern of a specific kind. Somebody who's the pattern, who everybody else would like to be, who stands out, who sets the standard, setting a good example. That's who we should be. That's what we have to be. We don't have a choice. That's part of our calling. That's part of who we are. We have to be mindful of that. It does make a difference. It is important. You and I are known by the example we set, whether we like it or not. People know you. They watch you. They see what you do. We probably don't give much thought each day about what others are thinking about us. But as Christians, that way of thinking has to change because we have to care. We have to be aware of what people are thinking. We represent the creator of everything. We have a special calling. We have a responsibility that we never dreamed of having, that God has given to us. It says in 1 John 3:2 that we, you and I, are the children of God. That's our calling. We are different. We can't be like everyone else. We have to be different. We have to go out of our way to set that good example. We have to have a mindset of who we are. We've been called to be an example for the rest of the world. That's why we're here. God has given us good examples to learn from all through the Bible. People just like you and I that God called, that God separated from the rest of the people and worked with. We can learn from them. We can learn from their example. God's given us His Holy Spirit to help us to overcome, help us to get through some tough times, help us to set that example for others. We don't know who God will send through these doors on any Sabbath. We have no idea. We have no control over that. Could be someone we work or worked with. It could be a childhood friend. It could be our neighbor. Or it could be the person we met in a place where we as Christians should not have been. We don't know who God's going to send through this door. We have to be aware of the example we set. We don't know who God will call. Let's turn to Acts 2. Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2 and in verse 39. Acts 2 and in verse 39. It says, for the promise is to you and to your children and to all who are far off, as many as the Lord our God will call. God does the calling. I get a lot of phone calls about people who are interested in the church. They take the literature and they have questions. So there are people out there who are interested. I remember a young man, and I may have mentioned this story before, a young man that I hired at Haslett Schools, and he worked there with us in 95 when the church split. And we didn't talk a lot of religion, didn't pay any attention to it. He knew what I believed. But he told me after the split, he said, I would have lost a lot of respect for you had you given up your beliefs, had you changed your beliefs, had you quit keeping the Sabbath and started keeping Sunday, if you started eating all kinds of food, if you quit keeping the holy days and the feast. I had no idea he paid attention to that. That he, you know, we talked about it, but didn't make a big deal of it. But he said he would have lost a lot of respect for me. He didn't agree with it. He didn't believe it. But he respected my beliefs. And he knew that I believed that. That's what we live by. So I really appreciated that. But it really opened my eyes to think, you know, people do watch. People do watch, especially around this time of year. You know, when they're caught up in the Christmas spirit here. What do we do? What do we do as Christians? How do we handle that? But they see a difference. How many of us have had people, our co-workers, family, or friends tell us, man, you know what, in December especially, I wish that was part of your church. This Christmas thing, it's expensive, it's stressful. I always buy the wrong gift or I always get the wrong gift. But they, you know, it's not a happy time for most people. It's stressful because it's not of God. You know, God's plan includes the holy days, the feasts, the Sabbath. Everything that has a meaning, that means something to our future, that means something to God as he brings us, as he works with us toward being in his kingdom, being part of his family. It has a meaning. But God's given us people in the Bible to learn from, to look at, to take their examples and take them and make them personal with us. So we'll first look at Abraham. And the example that Abraham set was the example of faith. Something we need, something that helps us, something that will keep us focused on God. Abraham's faith. And there's so many things we can learn from studying his life. And it's not to say that any of these people are perfect, just that we're just like we're not perfect. But we can learn things because the bottom line is they relied on God. They turned to God and looked to God for all that they had, all of their needs. But they didn't do it without mistakes because we're human beings. But when God first told Abram to relocate to a new, to a strange land, you know, he was 75 years old. And here, you know, comfortable, doing okay. God comes and says, you know, depart. Go to a place that I'll show you. Pick up everything. Just, this is what I want you to do. And Abram did it. He didn't look back. Let's go back to the book of Genesis 12. Genesis 12. And I know many of these verses we've read before, but there's just something we can learn every time we read them, every time we take a look at these examples. Genesis 12, and in verse 1, it says, Now the Lord said to Abram, Get out of your country from your kindred and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. This is what God told Abram. This is what I want you to do. This is your life. This is what I'm promising for you. Abram here in this promise was promised an heir. How can God build something from you if you have no heir to continue it on? To continue in that promise. But God made that promise to him. And many years went by before anything happened, before Abram could see that promise come about. But he questioned God about that, as any of us would do. Well, God, you promised me. I don't see anything going on. What's happening? Let's turn to chapter 15, Genesis 15. Genesis 15 and in verse 1. Genesis 15 and in verse 1. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward. Again, a reminder. But Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. Then Abram said, Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. I don't have any kids of my own. You made a promise, God, but so far I don't see anything happening. So he was getting impatient. And in verse 5 it says, Then he brought him outside and said, Look now toward heaven and count the stars if you are able to number them. And he said to him, So shall your descendants be. Again, God showing him, your descendants are going to be as the stars, the number of the stars. They're going to be so many. You can't even count them. And in verse 6 it says, And he, Abraham, believed. He believed in the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. Abraham believed him. Even though he hadn't seen anything physical yet, it was a promise from God, but Abraham believed him, believed that he would deliver. But as we sometimes can do, we can get impatient. Well, God says he's going to do this, but man, I wonder if I can make that happen. And what can I do to kind of hurry this along? Because I've been waiting a long time. That's human nature. Genesis 16. Genesis 16 and in verse 1. It says, Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children, coming to her own conclusion. Please go unto my maid, perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. They were going to make it happen. Well, you know, maybe this is what God wants. They reasoned that. Instead of waiting for God to do what he was going to do. So Abram took it upon himself to make it happen. Just like we can do sometimes. We get impatient. We don't wait. In Genesis 18, Genesis 18, and in verse 2, it says, So he lifted his eyes, talking about Abraham here, he says, He lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the ground. And in verse 9, it says, Then they said to him, Where is Sarah your wife? And he said, Here in the tent. And he said, I will certainly return to you according to the time of life. And behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son. And Sarah was listening in the tent door which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Again, coming to their own conclusions, we're old now. How could we have a child? So they took it upon themselves to do what they thought they needed to do. But it says, therefore, in verse 12, therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, After I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also. You know, we're old people. Abraham and I are just old. We're too old to have a family now. That was her thinking. And in verse 13 it says, And the Lord said to Abraham, Why did Sarah laugh, saying, Shall I surely bear a child since I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? That was his question. Do you think anything is too hard for me, that I can't do what I promised? I can't deliver? But here's the important verse. Part of that verse 14, he says, Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. God's appointed time. Not Abraham's, not Sarah's, but God's appointed time. He will keep his promise. He will deliver on that promise. not when they think it should be done, or not when we think it should be done, but when God thinks it should be done, at His appointed time, and we have to understand that. Genesis 22. After God comes through with His promise, Abraham and Sarah have a child. Isaac's born. They've waited on him for many years. Now he's here. And then what happens? Again, God comes to Abraham and says, I want you to take your son and sacrifice him to me. Now, what could have been going through Abraham's mind? Wow, why would God do that? You know, we've waited for this son to come for many years. He's been promised, but now he's asking me to sacrifice my son. But Abraham was willing to do that, knowing full well, because of his faith and trust in God, knowing full well, God will work this out. God will figure this out, and I'm going to leave it in his hands. And that's what he did. And in verse 11 of chapter 22, it says, when he was about to sacrifice Isaac, it said, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. What an example of faith. That a person would take their child and be willing to sacrifice that child to God because their faith was in God. They believed God. They loved God. Their loyalty was to God. And God's response was, now I know. Now I know that you love me, that you will obey me. What a great example of faith. But Abraham learned just like we do. He made mistakes just like we do. His conversion was a process just like ours is. You learn and you grow and you depend more and more on God, and your faith is growing in God and understanding that we can trust Him, that He will deliver on what He says. God has promised us a kingdom. God has promised us eternal life. He'll deliver that. We know through our faith He will deliver that. Not when we want, but when He wants. At His appointed time, we have to wait till He's ready to do that. We can certainly pray for that and should pray for that. But God will bring His kingdom at His appointed time. When He knows it's the right time, everything's right, He will do that. So Abraham set a great example of faith for us all to learn from, to turn ourselves over to God, to trust Him, to not get impatient, but to ask God for His will to be done in our lives and allow Him to do that. Joseph is another one that set an example for us. Joseph set an example of forgiveness. And that's been a problem in God's church, and I'm sure every other church since creation, is forgiveness. People have a tough time forgiving. Somebody offends us, somebody says something, somebody does something. It's hard to forgive. Human nature makes it hard to forgive. And certainly Satan plays a part in that too. Forgiveness. But Joseph sets an example. And as we'll read, as we'll see, and as we know his story, all that was done to him, all that he went through, and he was very forgiving. As we need to be. With each other. With our families. With our co-workers. With friends. Be forgiving. God has forgiven us. Jesus Christ has forgiven us. And we need to forgive one another and not hold grudges, but to let things go and to move on. Joseph, after trial, stayed on the course. He didn't give up. He didn't turn away from God. He turned towards God. He knew that God would get him through whatever trial he was going through at the time. Joseph wasn't very well liked by his brothers because he was different. And I can relate to that. I've got 10 brothers. I was different. I was good looking and smart. Okay. But Joseph was different because he had a good relationship, a special relationship with his dad. And he was just different than the rest of the brothers. They didn't like that. And the story of Joseph goes on to tell us that his brothers could not speak peaceably to him. They couldn't say a civil word to him. They were always down on him, criticizing him, didn't want him around. Never a nice word from his brothers. How would we like to live like that? When your siblings just don't want you around and make it known they don't want you around. Had to be a very stressful time. We know that Joseph had dreams. He had dreams. The mistake he made was he would share those dreams with his brothers. His brothers didn't take kindly to that either. Let's look at Genesis 37. Genesis 37. Genesis 37 and in verse 5. Genesis 37 and in verse 5. It says, now Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. But it goes on. It says in verse 6, so he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. He wanted to share it with them. In verse 7, there we were, binding sheaves in the field, working together, everybody doing their own thing. Then behold, my sheave arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brother said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Everything he said, they hated him a little more. He couldn't win. He had nowhere to go here. But not a good idea to share those dreams with your brothers who don't like you anyway. So his brothers plotted to do something. And we know the story. They were going to get rid of him one way or the other. They didn't want him around. So the brothers got together and said, you know what, let's just kill him. Let's just do away with him. We won't have to worry about that anymore. And if it weren't for Reuben, that would have happened. But in Genesis 37 and verse 20, Genesis 37 and verse 20, it says, come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. In other words, that'll put an end to it. But in verse 21, it says, but Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let's not kill him. Let's not do that. But we can throw him in a pit and leave him to die, but we won't shed his blood. So that's what they agreed on. But then they decided maybe there's more to it. Because Jude in verse 26 came up with a bright idea to make a little money. And in verse 26 we read, so Judah said to his brothers, what profit, and that's what was on his mind, money, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Doesn't do anybody any good. Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be on him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers listened. So they just decided to sell him. Let's just sell him. We'll make a buck. We're not shedding his blood. We can go home feeling good about ourselves, and we're rid of him. We don't have to listen to him anymore. So that's what they did. They sold him to some traders. And we know, too, that Joseph ended up in Egypt. He ended up working for Potiphar, and that he was given favor by Potiphar, and he was running the house. He was the overseer of the house. So Joseph probably started thinking, you know, hey, this isn't too bad. Out of all of this I came through, I ended up here, got a good job, it's clean, you know, I'm warm, and everything's going okay. It's not what I would have if it was my doing, but I'm here. I'm a slave. It's going to work out okay. Well, we know that didn't last long. The boss's wife, as Scripture tells us, says she was casting her longing eyes on Joseph. She had something else in mind for Joseph rather than him doing the dishes or sweeping the floor. she had a different idea. Let's turn to Genesis 39. Genesis 39 and verse 8. Because she had been after Joseph to commit adultery. But in verse 8 it says, "But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Look, my master does not know what is with me in this house. And he has committed all that he has to my hand. He trusts me. He gives me authority here. He gives me responsibility. There is no one greater in this house than I. Nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?'" That's what was on Joseph's mind. God. What kind of an example would I set if I did that? That would not be an example that I would set, because I would be sinning against my God. Again, showing us the commandments were in place even before Moses received them on Mount Sinai. Sin. Adultery. Joseph wasn't going to break God's commandments. He wasn't going to sin. Joseph would not betray his boss. His human boss, but more importantly, he would not betray God. And in verse 10, "So it was as he spoke to she spoke to Joseph day after day," again, just day after day after day, trying to get him to change his mind. "And so it was as he spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, 'Lie with me.' But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside." No way, lady, not happening. And he took off, and she just grabbed his robe or whatever he had on, his outer garment, and she had that. And that would play a big part in convincing her husband that Joseph had tried to attack her. She had his outer garment to prove it. And she went to her husband and lied about Joseph because she was upset that he wouldn't have anything to do with her. Joseph was put into prison for his crime. And again, he's in prison. But we're told that God gave Joseph favor with the person who ran the prison. God was there looking out for Joseph, helping him. And time after time, when Joseph could have said, "Poor, poor me," and given up, he continued to set a positive example. In Genesis 50, everything's been done. Joseph is the second in command in Egypt. His family's come there. God has blessed him well. His brothers know who he is. And everything's going okay. But then, Jacob dies. And here we pick up here in chapter 50 and in verse 15, where his brother's mindset happened to be. In verse 15 of chapter 50, it says, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him.'" That was their problem. They knew that Joseph had the power, and now that their dad was gone to protect them, what's Joseph going to do? Is he going to get even now? So they made up a little story. "So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, 'Before your father died, he commanded, saying, Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' And Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for I'm in the place of God. I'm here because this is where God wanted me to be.' I know that. But as for you, you meant evil against me. He reminded them of that. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. There was a reason all of this happened. God used Joseph. And in verse 21, now therefore do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now he had the power to have them all hung, but he didn't do that. He forgave them for all that they did to him, all the pain and suffering they caused him. He forgave them. He moved on. He trusted God. He put his faith in God. And he knew what he was supposed to do, and that was to be forgiving. And he did that. Hopefully we can do that. We can learn from Joseph's example. None of us will ever hopefully be sold as a slave or put in a pit or have anything like that happen to us. But Joseph did have that happen. But he set that example of forgiveness for us. Another example set for us was set by Moses. And he set an example of leadership. He set an example of leadership. A position he did not want, he didn't look for, didn't ask for, was happy doing anything but being in that role. A man who started from humble beginnings to become royalty, to give that up, ended up tending sheep, ended up with a wife and some children, happy and content. I got a job, I've got a family, I'm good, I'm okay. But God had something else in mind for Moses. Let's turn to Exodus 2, Exodus chapter 2. And in verse 23, Exodus 2 and in verse 23. Exodus 2 and in verse 23. Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered. He remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. He remembered that promise that he had made to Abraham. And he needed someone to take the role, the leadership role, to go in and bring his chosen people, Israel, out of bondage. Who did he choose? He chose Moses. And Moses tried to talk his way out of that. I'm not an eloquent speaker. I don't do well in front of people. Don't do well in crowds. Not me. You got the wrong guy. My speech is slow. Went to school with a guy from, I think he's from West Virginia, and he could drag the words out, you know, that southern drawl. Good morning. That's kind of how he talked. Well, maybe Moses talked that way. Maybe Moses just talked slow and had a drawl. Maybe he was from southern Egypt. I don't know. But he was trying to convince God that you got the wrong guy for the job. I'm not your man. You need somebody else. But God, again, knew who he wanted. He wanted Moses to do this. He had the right man. He just had to work with him, convince him that he was the right person. Exodus 12. Exodus 12. And in verse 40. Exodus 12 and in verse 40. We know that Moses was successful. Even with all of the setbacks, all of the times Pharaoh changed his mind, everything happened that shouldn't have happened. But Moses kept going on because he knew that God had put him there, had chosen him to lead the people out of slavery. In verse 40 of Exodus 12, it says, "Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. 430 years in captivity. Long time. And in verse 41, "And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." Moses, because he submitted himself to God, because he set that example of leadership that the others followed. Not all, not 100%, but all of those who trusted God followed Moses. All of those who looked to God for their deliverance followed Moses because of his leadership, because of the example he set of being locked into God. And we were able to witness positive examples as we turn through the pages of the Bible. We can see that all through the Bible. David is another one. David is a prime example for us of courage. Because sometimes we kind of cower down as Christians. We don't know if we want to move on here. We want to take that on, or we can get through this trial, or we can handle this or that or the other thing. It takes courage as a Christian to be able to keep going forward and not cower down and back up and give in. And most everybody knows the story of David and Goliath, a young man who trusted God to deliver him, who knew he couldn't do it by himself. There was no fooling himself. He didn't even try. He knew without God there was no possible way he could do what he had to do. Israel was on one side of the valley while the Philistines were on the other side, and they were waiting to go to battle with each other. Just waiting there. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 17. 1 Samuel 17. First Samuel 17 and verse 3. 1 Samuel 17 and verse 3. It says, "The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span." Now, I don't know what a cubic or a span is, but I think that was big. "He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels. And a shield bearer went before him. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, 'Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you a servant of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servant. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us.' And the Philistine said, I dare you guys. I dare you all. None of you have enough guts to come out and face me.' But he says, 'I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.'" Now, he was talking to a whole army, and not one person from that army stood out and said, "I'll take you." They didn't do that. They all stood back. Nobody came forward. Then in verse 20, we pick the story up here. David had 3 brothers serving in the army, in Saul's army. And his father was having David take supplies to his brothers. So David, not knowing what was going on, he comes into the scene here. And it says, "So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shouting for battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hands of the supply keeper and ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. He says, what's going on? Seeing what's happening there with his brothers. And then as he talked with them, there was a champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words, so David heard them. He heard Goliath telling the Israelites the same thing. Have any of one of you over there got enough guts to come and face me? And they didn't. And in verse 24 it says, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. This is a whole army. One man, Goliath, and he's got a whole army running, dreadfully afraid of him. So the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel, and it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption in Israel. Just, we need one of you guys to go up here. I'll give you, you know, I'll reward you handsomely, but we need somebody to come forward and take this guy on. Nobody came forward. And in verse 26, then David spoke to the man who stood by him, saying, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he could defy the armies of the living God? David had the right picture. He had the right focus. This wasn't Saul's army. This was God's army. They were missing the whole picture. The army couldn't get by the physical. But David did. He saw beyond the physical. This is God's army. They have God's blessing. They have God's strength behind them. And people answered, but David was just inquiring, well, what's in it for the guy who takes him out? And the people answered him in this manner, saying, so shall it be done for this man who kills him. And he was talking about getting all of that reward. Now his older brother heard, when he heard this, when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger, it says, now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. I think his brother was probably a little embarrassed that here's his little brother, and he saw everybody cowering back. And David said, what have I done now? Is there not cause? What, I haven't done anything. Just came up to bring you guys some supplies, see what's going on, and I see all of this going on here, all this taking place. Then he returned from him toward another and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first ones did. And when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. They're saying, hey, there's some crazy kid down here. He says, he'll go take on Goliath. What do you think? Saul says, bring him up. Nobody else would go up there. Then David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. I'll do it. And Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing as he has defiled the armies of the living God again. David knew what was going on. He trusted God with his whole being. I can do this because God's on my side. Moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. So Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put a bronze helmet on his head, and he also clothed him with a coat of mail. And David fastened his sword to his armor, and he tried to walk, and he couldn't walk, all of this armor. And I'm sure it was the most advanced armor that they had to that date. But it was so heavy, David couldn't walk with it. So he took it off. He says, I can't walk with these, for I have not tested them. So David took them off. In verse 39, it says, then he took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, and put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had in his sling. And in his sling was in his hand. And he drew near to the Philistine. So the Philistines came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and good-looking. You know, Goliath just couldn't believe what was going on. What's happening here? This young kid they sent out here, because they're all gutless, they're all cowards, and they sent this little kid out here to take me on. So the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give you flesh. I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. David knew where his strength was. That was his courage. He put everything he had, his life, in God's hands that day. He knew what he was doing. But God was there with him. He trusted God. Always referring to the army of God, not Saul's army, but God's army. By these examples, we can learn. We can grow as Christians. Just as God called each one of these people to himself, he's called you and I to himself. We need to have the faith, forgiveness, leadership, and courage that they had. We need to be locked in to our calling, to be faithful to God, to show God that we trust him no matter what. Our faith is in him. To show that we will forgive those who have hurt us, who have sinned against us, as we ask God to forgive us for sins against him. We'll have that leadership because we will have to have, as we teach, as we help the world understand God's truth, we will have to be leaders. So they will follow us. They will want to follow us by the example we set, just as Israel wanted to follow Moses by the example that he set. And we have to have courage. We have to be courageous in who we are, in our calling, and that God has set us apart. He's given us something to do. And sometimes it's scary. Sometimes it's stressful. Sometimes we want to turn around and go back, but we can't do that. There's no turning around for us. We have to head on. There was no turning around for Abraham, no turning around for Moses or David. We have to keep going forward. We have to follow the number one example in the Bible, Jesus Christ, because he had all of these things. He had faith. He forgave. He was our leader and is our leader, and he had courage. He had the courage to stand up for God, for God's truth, for his Father. He had the courage to give his life for each one of us because of his love, because of the future that he and his Father had planned for us. So as Christians, does our example mean anything? Is it important that we set an example for others? Should we care about the example we set? You bet we should. We need to be mindful of that. People watch us. People look at us. Are they the real deal? Do they live what they believe? Do they walk the walk? And as Christians, that should be us. That should describe us. Just as these men we looked at here and the trials they went through to prove their loyalty, their dedication, their faithfulness to God, to set that example. That's where we are today, to set that example to prove to God, to prove to others who we are, that we are called out, that we are special, that we are set aside by the Creator God Himself, and that we understand that it's our obligation, that it's our duty to set that example for all of the other people that one day may walk through those doors as God calls them and brings them to us for an example of people who obey Him, who worship Him, who love Him, and who obey Him.